Hello, everybody. Welcome to our chill Friday night Q&A hangout. If you would like to grow as an artist and you can take an art class, we've got everything you need here at Art Prof: critiques, tutorials, professional development, and workshops. Give me an update on how your week has been in general or artistically. I believe we could all use a artistic checkup, which is why we have these live streams on Friday night. You know what I did this week, which I was very proud about? I cleaned my shelves. My shelves are out of control right now. They're so bad. And I hate cleaning, but I decided this week, enough. I don't need to live like this anymore. And a reminder to everybody, drop your questions into the chat. Feel free to pick my brain about anything, because chances are you've got something you're thinking about in relation to your artwork. Maybe it's not even the art. Maybe it's a business thing, selling, or maybe you're thinking about school or applications, which is already starting to ramp up. And I tell a lot of students, listen, if you're smart, you get the feedback early. Because I do think, and I've seen this in other places too, not just art school portfolios, that people oftentimes think the only time a critique would be productive is when the piece is finished. And certainly there's a lot to go over when you're critiquing a finished artwork, but I have actually found that it's the work in progress critiques where you get in there early, you catch fundamental things in the piece that you have not spent 20 hours on, that it's so easy to make those changes. It's easy to explore things without that investment of time. And so actually for a lot of people, the work in progress critique is more productive, especially if you're looking at somebody's thumbnails. There are oftentimes so many things that are really a pain in the butt to change once you're working on a big spell canvas. But when you can change it with just a couple marks of your eraser or pencil in your thumbnails, it feels so easy. And it's nice to feel like you caught something which would have been a problem later on. And so I actually encourage people to get feedback early, because that happens a lot with art school portfolios, is people will make the entire portfolio and then they ask for feedback 2 weeks before the deadline. And it's almost like at that point, I can't really help them that much because the portfolio is done and there's not a lot you're going to do within 2 weeks to really throw something together. And so I am a big fan of getting that feedback early on, because a lot of things are not difficult to fix in an artwork at that stage, but they're such a hassle later. And I also feel like none of us like to feel like we're doing any backtracking. A lot of us like to feel like we're moving forward and making progress. And when you have to go back and undo things, I think that never feels that great for a lot of people. I mean, I'm not saying you should never do that, because, oh dear, I've had a lot of paintings where it's just like redo, undo, redo. It just keeps going back and forth. And that's totally fine as well. Wow, Alexandria, your piece in a local juried gallery show was awarded. Congratulations. That must feel incredible. I'm so proud of all of you when you hit those milestones that are meaningful to you, because certainly making the artwork is a big part of that. But I do think a lot of artists, and tell me in the chat if you feel this is important, I do think a lot of us, we want to be seen and we want to be validated. I think sometimes that's something that a lot of people struggle with. And I know for a lot of people, sometimes that validation is the first time you saw an artwork. Doesn't have to be. I mean, maybe it's you got into a show, or maybe you got a compliment from somebody who you really respect. But I think we all seek some form of validation in some format or another. And so I'm so proud of you. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Jessica's asking, how do you feel about grad school? I've been debating it. It depends on what you want to do, because getting an MFA, if that's what you're referring to, it's the terminal degree for a fine artist. It's not always necessary. There are so many things you can do to create a lively studio practice that do not involve an MFA. It's a very small percentage of people that do an MFA degree compared to the larger world of artists. And really, the only absolute reason you would have to do an MFA degree is if you want to teach at the college level. Yes, that for sure, you can't get away without that MFA. But I oftentimes tell people that a residency is an excellent choice, because the way an artist residency is set up is you have some time period that you're at the residency. Most of them are pretty long. Most of them are at least a month. Sometimes you'll find one that's 2 weeks, but that's not that common. There are some that are really long. There are some that are like a whole year. But I think that a lot of people who want to go back and do MFA degrees, what they really want is a focused practice. And sometimes a residency can really do that for you, especially residencies that are not just visual artists. There's a whole bunch out there where you're with creative people in all different fields. The McDowell Colony in New Hampshire is one of those. And I think we just want that creative sustenance for ourselves to make sure we are getting that nurturing quality, I suppose. Jesse says, if I had any question, I want to learn more about composition. I struggle for some reason with plopping this in the middle. I don't know why. I think that's super common. I think if we're not really thinking hard about it, let's say you do a portrait, your first impulse is right in the middle. I mean, your average person is not going to put the head upside down. That's not very typical. And I think what I would try to do with composition, one of my favorite things is trying to find diagonals. So actually, I can show you guys right now. So in composition, if you have a brush and it's standing straight up, or you have one that is perfectly horizontal, there's a stability to that. And so oftentimes, if you have like a bunch of perfect vertical lines, it tends to make the composition not have a lot of movement. And I like to think about composition as a means to get my viewer to move around the composition. So if my viewer just goes straight for the face and they have no interest in the other corners of the composition, in my mind, and again, this is not for everybody, I don't think I've done a good composition, because I haven't made the other parts of the composition interesting. For example, a lot of people don't pay attention to corners and edges. And actually, when you have things cropped going off the page, that's a way to engage with the edge of the page. So you're developing a reason, like, why as a viewer would I want to bother looking at that thing in the upper right-hand corner? And so that's what you want to try to do. So what works for me, anytime I can make a diagonal, that is an action. That means something starting at the bottom and moving upwards. And it's way more active than a line that does that. Now, not all compositions have to be about movement or being dynamic, but it's a good place to start just to switch things up, try to find some of those diagonals. Hi, Beth. Welcome. So lovely to have you here for the first time. What people mean by describing something as being muddy? Can you explain? Usually muddy in the context of visual art, mostly people are talking about color, although they could be talking about something else, but that's how I would interpret it. So for example, color saturation is how intense or muted a color is. So if you guys look at my shirt, my shirt is a really bright, intense red. So if I wanted to paint my shirt, I probably would get red and get the red right out of the tube. Because when a color comes straight out of a tube, that is the highest intensity and saturation that the color can have. Now, the second I mix another color into that red, it gets a little bit more muted. So if you look at my shirt, there's like an area here, which is all shadow. That's not as bright as like this side over here. And so usually muddy colors are colors that look really gray, or I don't know, I always think about puke green or something like that. So it's a color which is very low in intensity. And actually my brushes are very muddy looking. So that's usually what people are talking about. But I suppose it could be also put in another context, like maybe saying that something in a composition is too vague, or maybe that it doesn't, maybe it lacks articulation. So if you want to follow up with something more specific, Beth, I'm happy to take a look at that. And Brandon says, watch some of your videos on character design and storytelling. Was wondering if you had any interest in making a comic or had a story to tell. Not at the moment. That hasn't really been much of my focus. I've never really wanted to create a comic. I love comics. I mean, I grew up with comics. That's all I read. And some of those images from the comics that I read, I mean, they're imprinted into my brain. They were incredibly influential to me as an artist, but I've never really had the desire to do that. But what I do like doing, seeing other people do it. So some of you guys may know that Kat Huang, who's a teaching artist here, she is creating a graphic novel right now called Nostalgia. It's going to be published probably in a few years. She's still working on it, but I love seeing that process. Ho Long says, which do you prefer, acrylic inks or oil paint? At the moment, I would say acrylic inks. But usually the reason I'm working with a particular material is because it fits the project that I want to do. Oils are a little bit of a hassle for me because I don't have a bona fide artist studio. In the winter, I can't paint with all my windows open and stuff like that. So from a practical standpoint, oil doesn't work for me right now, but I do love oil paint. And if I ever have a project where it seems like oil paint is the best fit for that, totally, I'll do it. But I guess I need a studio first, or I need to move to a tropical place where it's nice and warm all year round and I can open my windows for ventilation. Yams says, I got carpal tunnel syndrome. Oh gosh, I'm so sorry. And I have a live drawing competition in a few days. Do you know any at-home remedies that have worked or helped for you or other artists? Oh, I'm so sorry you're dealing with that. I never had carpal tunnel, but I did have something called de Quervain's tenosynovitis, where it's like this, I don't know the medical thing, but it is this thing in my wrist and it was really bad. I couldn't write my name and I had braces on my arms and I did physical therapy for a long time. And thank goodness I was able to recover from it. But, and again, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not trying to give you anything that should ever be seen as medical advice. But I know for a lot of people, having a brace is really helpful. And I know Lauren Welch, who's a teaching artist here, she recently had hand surgery and wasn't able to paint for a really long time. She's coming out of it. She's largely recovered. But it's very difficult. I would say something to support your wrist is probably good. But again, I don't know a huge amount about the physical therapy side of that, but I'm sorry you're dealing with that. And Lisa says, a classmate is having a hard time drawing icons instead of what they see. Is there a simple exercise to help her? That's a really great question, because that happens all the time, where basically people draw what they think something looks like instead of using their eyes to really look and represent the thing. A really good example, I think, actually is fish. This happened all the time when I was teaching younger kids or high school students. So you'd ask people to draw a fish and they would just draw that cartoon fish that is, I don't know, shaped like a football and has a triangle tail. And you knew when you looked at what they were drawing from that they were not looking, because they were drawing their idea of a fish, which is not the same thing as observing a fish. So I think maybe a way to do it is to take the drawing that she did that looks like the icon. So let's say the cartoon fish, okay? And then draw a version where you're really clearly observing something and put them side by side. And I think sometimes that comparison is what gets people to realize that, oh, wow, that is more of an idea of what I thought I saw. I wasn't really looking. Sometimes that's enough to jolt people into seeing that difference, because you usually can't see the difference unless somebody's really pointing it out to you. And then drawing something really simple that has some nuances, something that is not super complicated, and just getting them to learn how to use their eyes is hard. So much of drawing is training your eye. People think it's all in the hand, but it is absolutely your eye, training your eye to see things. Like, we just did the color palettes workshop this Saturday, and colors the exact same way. I mean, you can mix colors, but you really have to train yourself to see colors. Like, that's the hardest thing. And once you can see something, like, a lot of people will say to me, well, I don't understand why you put green in a face, because we usually do not think about ourselves as having green skin. But a lot of it is about having the experience of seeing that green. It might be a very subtle green that maybe is not super obvious, but it's there if you look hard enough for it. And by the way, people, we are also doing registration for the May and June workshops: flowers, acrylic painting, printmaking party, pen and ink, collage, and also landscapes in water, landscapes with water. So if you want to register for one of our workshops, you can go down to the video description below and take a look. They're really fun. Our workshops are more like 2 weeks. People don't realize that. They think it's just the 3-hour session, but I provide written support and feedback the week before the live session and the week after. So actually, it's more like a 2-week workshop. Okay. He's asking, what other creative pursuit are you engaged in? Not at the moment, but I was a classical musician for a really long time. I played the oboe with a lot of community orchestras. I did it when I was RISI student. I used to play with the Brown University Orchestra, and I miss it, but I can't make space for it right now, because the whole thing, it's sort of like athletics. It's like really painful to play soccer if you're terribly out of shape. And it's almost like you'd rather not do it than play it in a painful manner, because it is like that. It's like being out of shape. And I just don't have time to practice regularly, but that has been a part of my life in the past. Susan says, have you looked into the rule of thirds? I think they call it the golden ratio. I don't think is that the same thing? I don't know. Somebody clarify. Is the rule of thirds the same thing as the golden ratio? I don't think it is, but I could be wrong. We do have a stream, Susan, on the rule of thirds. Just look up Art Prof rule of thirds in YouTube. You'll find it. And you know something? I never used it. Lauren has used it quite a bit, and I think Jordan did as well, but I never have. And I think it's just because I just don't like those structures. I feel like, for me, they feel a little bit forced. But I know some people love the rule of thirds. I know the rule of thirds can be extremely helpful for some people as a departure point, but it never was really a part of what I did. I guess I never really had a class in art school that taught the rule of thirds. So maybe that's why I never used it. Thank you so much, Nick, for the super sticker. We so much appreciate your support. Amazing to have that. And by the way, everybody, those super stickers and super chats, they do add up. And so keep them coming, because they do matter to us. And scrolling up to find, gosh, I'm so behind in the chat. Here we go. Beth says, I have heard critiques other than art prof. Okay, so this is a follow-up question about muddy that talks so negatively about an area being too muddy. Why is that so bad? It doesn't have to be. Depends on the piece. It's hard for me to say without having a concrete reference, but you know something? You need muddy colors. People don't think that they are helpful because they're kind of icky. Puke green is not that pretty, but you know something? Muddy colors are critical because if you don't have muddy colors, then everything is bright. It's like overload. So like I'm wearing this red shirt. If the whole screen was bright red, it would be too much. Like you wouldn't want to watch the stream because it'd be way too much red. And so muddy colors are important because they make the saturated colors, the bright colors, make them brighter. Like if you put a bright color next to a bright color, it doesn't really look that exciting. But if you put a muddy color next to a bright color, that bright color is going to really, really sing. And again, it depends on the piece. So for example, Degas, he uses tons of muddy colors. If you guys look at Degas' oil paintings, they really don't have that many bright colors. They do here and there, but most of his colors are pretty muted. So I would just say, Beth, it's not an inherently bad thing. It can be. I mean, if you have a painting that's like all muddy and you can't see anything and you don't know what's going on, like that's not a good thing. But I don't think muddy colors are an inherently bad thing. In fact, they are very important in some circumstances. Piggy Butts asking if there's any way to begin a painting with pan pastels and then bring in acrylics. I guess the only thing I would worry about with pan pastels is that they're very dusty. They're like soft pastels. And I would worry that they'd get disrupted by the acrylics so much that you would just lose them altogether, which at that point, it's like the pan pastels aren't really helping you that much if you just end up getting rid of them with the acrylics. But you know what I have done with pan pastels? Who here has tried pan pastels? Because they're a relatively new art supply, and the company sent me a bunch of their supplies for me to try out on a live stream. Just look up Art Prof Pan Pastels, you'll find it. And I really didn't like them that much by themselves. I feel like if I use them in conjunction with something else, they would be fine, but they were just not, I guess, intense enough for me. Like everything I did with them just felt too light and too thin. Although maybe I just have no patience and couldn't figure it out. But so what I did on the stream about pan pastels is I used Caran d'Ache Neocolor crayons on top of it. And so that actually was a nice blend because the crayons were nice and solid. And then the pan pastels are really good for filling in some of those midtones. But I guess that was my main frustration, is just that you just couldn't get the dark that I wanted. Janet's asking, curious about some of the mixed media I paint with gold and acrylic, but there are some mixed media things where it's thicker and three-dimensional, best way to learn is. There's a lot. I mean, you could go nuts looking at how much stuff Golden offers. What you could try is, I think it's called soft gel matte, but that one's really thick. I mean, you could pipe it out of a pastry bag and it would look like frosting. There's also, for something more coarse, they do have, I think it's called pumice gel. It might be something else, but I'm pretty sure the word pumice gel is in there. Or I know Lauren has mixed old coffee grounds into her work. So what I would just do is maybe buy one of those mediums and just play around with it for a little bit, because it's really exciting. You can do amazing things. And... oh, Piggy Butt is following up, wondering about clear gesso, maybe. I think the clear gesso would just wipe out the pan pastels. I'm guessing. I could be wrong. You can definitely give it a shot and report back. Let us know if it works. Okay, Uma's asking, many government-funded art galleries and museums have open calls for artists to engage the public or have work that interests a certain group like children. How do you adapt your work to fit that? I guess it really depends on what they're asking for, because usually when there's an open call, like a juried exhibition or something like that, they usually have some kind of theme. Like, there's this place in Boston, Cambridge Art Association, they always had themes based on color. So they'd say, okay, this is the blue show. Other times they say, well, it must address this certain issue and this is about engaging people with that. So I think you can adapt yourself to that for sure, but I wouldn't do that just to be in the show, just so you can enter. I think there are so many places you can apply to that will not require you to change the way you work, because I think unless you really, really want to change the way you work, it's probably not a great investment of your time artistically. At least for me, I wouldn't want to do that. But again, it depends on the person. But you have to really look at what they want, because every single art venue out there, regardless of whether it's government funded or not, is so different. Every single one wants a different thing. Like, for example, if you have an exhibition at a local library, lots of libraries do that, you can't really have anything that upsets people from an image standpoint. And I remember the local library where I used to live in Massachusetts had something about that. They were saying, listen, we don't want work that is going to really start fires or anything for us. So the important thing is to read it and say, is this actually a good fit for me? And do I really want to do it? Because I know a lot of people will sort of bend over backwards to change themselves so they can do that opportunity, when really there's so many other opportunities that can be just as fun, if not better. And Piggy Butt says, would love to do a workshop, but time zones are tricky. Wonder if there's any plans for varying up the time of the workshops in the future. Not at the moment, mostly because my family's schedule on the weekends I have to adhere to. Maybe someday. I mean, for those of you guys who aren't able to do the workshops, there's also the option of doing Open Studios Club. Open Studios Club is a really fun way that we can have a chill session. You work on your personal projects. They're 2 hours at a time, so you can really spend time making a piece. And it's similar to the workshop in that you are getting feedback right as you make the work, because that's the thing that a lot of people, I think, really appreciate about the workshops, is that the workshops, you're making something and you're getting feedback immediately. And that's very different than when you make something, you're not working on it anymore, you show it to somebody, and there's value in that as well. I mean, that's what we offer in our Patreon group, which I know a lot of people really enjoy. But Open Studios Club could be an option for you, because we have two sessions each week and they're at different times. And one of them is an evening time for people on the East Coast. So that might align a little bit better. So if you guys want information about Open Studios Club, just go down to the video description below. Okay. So it looks like people are talking about, there's a whole party in here. I love so much that you guys are all supporting each other and answering each other's questions. Really, really helpful. Brandon says, do you have any advice for enjoying the process? I often find myself becoming anxious to see the final result of a piece. Causes me to subconsciously rush and make the drawing worse. Don't think about the product. Really, really try not to. I know it's hard. I know we want to feel like we're working towards something and that we have expectations, that we're trying to accomplish something, but honestly, it's just going to stress you out. I think a lot of it is trying to manage your expectations, because oftentimes that is the thing that frustrates people. And it's not because they're not good at drawing or because they're not doing a good job. It's just when we expect the artwork to be a certain way or to come out a certain way. And then if you don't meet that, it's going to be disappointing. And so the way to remove that is just don't have those expectations. What I suggest to a lot of people is, listen, listen to something else. Listen to a podcast. Something where you have to like focus. I don't mean music. I mean, it depends on the person. But I do find that if I'm listening to a podcast, sometimes I listen to NPR and I'm really focused on that. It's sort of a degree of distraction where it's not so distracting that I can't make the work, but it's enough to take my mind off that, because the thing about that anxiety is it doesn't help you at all. It only makes it more stressful. So Janice says, which medium makes you go in a flow state and why? I mean, oils, watercolor, or pastels? I don't think it's based on the media. I think it's just based on my personal engagement with the work that I'm doing. And honestly, you know what really gets my flow state? It's the silliest thing. Staying up late at night. You know why? Because nobody can bother me, because I've got two kids. I have this business here. And I am the final word for a lot of things. So I am responsible for a lot of things during the day. People are always talking to me and needing things during the day. And for me, that flow state can only be achieved if nobody can bother me. So if I stay up late, everybody's asleep, I'm like, oh, I can find my flow in seconds because I know I won't be interrupted. I don't know what other people's lives are like, but my life is a constant series of interruptions. Just all day, there's always something. And I'm always like, oh, I cleared this 2-hour chunk and then something happens and I have to like get up and go do something. So tell me in the chat, do you have constant interruptions in your life, or are you able to find those nice chunks of time when you can just really engage with the work? Alexandria says, saw a quote by you about the idea of open walls in galleries. It would be great if galleries offered that. Yeah, in case you guys missed it, actually, I'm going to talk about it on Sunday, because the Sunday stream is going to be art news, which is a new thing. We're just giving it a shot. But this is the article that was mentioned. And yes, I feel very validated being on NPR. That is my validation as an artist. So some of you guys may have heard that somebody who is on a museum staff, like somebody who is, I don't know exactly what they were doing, but I think they were installing. So they were like part of the crew or something. And he hung his own painting into the gallery. And I guess it sat there for a while before they discovered it. And so on NPR, they asked me about what I thought about that, which was, I had a really good chuckle when I heard about that, because I was like, oh, that's an exhibition opportunity that has never occurred to me before. So I found that really funny. I mean, I think it would be nice for people to have more spaces where they can show their work, but I do think that it's a logistical thing, which is a crazy amount of work. And you would need like a whole staff of people to handle something like that. Because I think if there's anything I've learned, especially because I was a gallery director, it is just so much work. Just to get work on the wall. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it's a ton of work to install a show. I don't know if anybody here has done before. Let me know in the chat if you have. But when we hung those gallery shows, I mean, we were there for like 10 hours. And it's very much invisible work. So for example, if an artwork is like just the simplest thing, let's just say oil painting on canvas, even that you have to measure things. And it's the type of work that looks terrible if you do a slightly not great job, but if it's really well done, nobody notices. It's kind of like restaurant service. Like if the restaurant service is really good, you sort of don't notice it. But if it's very, very bad, you definitely notice. And the galleries are kind of like that. So that's the only thing, is that you would really need a whole crew of people to take care of that. River says, recently, I've been having some trouble with getting inspiration or ideas for my artwork. Most of my concepts have been feeling repetitive and boring. Any tips? Try the opposite. Or like if you've been painting flowers, pick something that is nothing like flowers. Pick something that is not natural. Pick something that is maybe made out of metal or something. Like, try to think of something that's like so far from the thing that you've been doing. So let's say you've been doing paintings of your favorite Broadway shows. Maybe the follow-up is people who are in everyday mundane situations. Because you think about Broadway, it's like, lights and all these incredible, beautiful things. And it's like, if you think about, okay, what's the most boring scene I could ever paint of a person and make it really quiet and slow of a painting, that's a challenge. So sometimes you do that. But the other thing too, I haven't released this reel yet, but Alex Kiesling, who's one of my former students, he's a really successful illustrator now. And he said the way he gets ideas is, number one, he has a lot of mood boards. So he's always like collecting things. So anytime he sees something that's interesting to him, he'll just put it in his Pinterest board. And he said what works really well for him, he calls it cross-pollination. So let's say you have a mood board and one is all iguanas and another one is, let's say, deserts that have buildings in them. I have no idea. But he said, you take these two things that seem like they have nothing to do with each other and you put them together into an image. So maybe you're looking at blood cells, or maybe you're looking at baseball players. It's like, how do those two things interact? So that's a cute exercise that you could try. And Lisa says, I understand many younger artists are focused on finding their style. While I understand wanting to be you, where is this intense focus on style come from? Honestly, I think it's social media. I think social media has pushed people to be that way, especially with younger artists. And I think it doesn't help that you get an artificial representation of how people develop a style, because developing a style takes years. It is not something that you just wake up and decide to do. And so the problem is, because social media works so fast, and because you see just finished pieces and you see people who already have a style, you don't get to see the people who are really working hard to get there. And you don't see people struggling for 10 years to really feel like they know who they are creatively. And so we're missing that piece, that slow burn that it takes. I mean, I still feel like I don't have a style, but of course everybody I talk to is like, yeah, you totally do. I'm like, I don't feel like I do, but that's where I'm gonna guess. And Susan says, I never have enough time. Involved in too many charity works keeps interfering with my art. I feel like everybody has something. There's something in your life that is creating a little block in your artistic life. For me, it's my kids. I mean, if you have two teenagers, oh gosh, everything's an emergency. I feel like an ER doctor a lot of the time. And I'm sorry, I don't know how to say your name. Anas, I'm concerned about inhaling charcoal while drawing. Do you wear a mask while drawing? I don't, but if you're worried about it, yeah, wear a mask. That should probably take care of it. I mean, one thing I don't do is if there's like a lot of powder on my drawing, I won't like blow it off. Like, I usually just pick up my drawing board, I put it over a garbage can and I get the powder off like that. So that's something you can do, but I'm not super worried about that. Leda is asking, in your opinion, who is a professional artist? What does that really mean? When does someone become a professional? Degree, gallery representation, most of your income is from art. It can mean any kind of thing, but I can tell you that you do not have to be a full-time artist to be a professional artist. The common misconception, people assume that, well, to be a professional artist, that must mean that all of my income is from selling my work. Because actually, there are so many professional artists who do not make most of their income from their art. I mean, pretty much every artist in academia, the academia part, that's their bread and butter. And so you are expected to have a professional practice if you are teaching at a college, but most people, that's not their main income. I mean, some people, yes,
but there are tons of people in academia for whom that was not the case. I mean, it was for me. When I was teaching at RISD, I would sell stuff here and there, but it really wasn't my thing. I was really focused on exhibitions. But I think usually it means you have engaged with some professional organization. So that could be, okay, you teach at college, or maybe you have done residencies. I mean, there's no hard line to say, oh, you're a pro, you're not. I think as long as you have been engaging with others, and a lot of times it is financial. So for example, if somebody's painting a lot, that's fantastic, but that doesn't necessarily make them a professional artist. So if you show at a gallery, or I don't know, it's a really hard question to answer. So I don't want anyone to feel like there's a hard definition here, but I think for everybody it's different. But I would say if you're just hanging out at home painting and that's it, that's not a professional artist, and that's fine. Not everybody wants to be a professional artist. In fact, sometimes being a professional artist stinks. People think it's amazing because they're like, oh, I get to do all my time making my artwork. It's not true. I am not kidding you guys. I think 90% of what I do here is marketing and promotion. The content creation is such a small piece. And it's the same case with the professional artists. You have to do your own accounting. You have to send invoices. You have to promote. And so this fantasy of being a professional artist, being a full-time artist, it's not as great as people might think it to be. I actually think about it more as a lifestyle choice than a holy grail that we need to live up to. Okay, so Shweta says, so I create a story in my painting. The problem I face lately is my sketch is ready, but when I start coloring, I get very anxious. So I don't know what your work looks like, but I do think it's really helpful to do sketches in color. So if you tell yourself, this is just a sketch, it's not the finished piece, because I do that all the time. So I'll do a bunch of sketches that are in pencil. Maybe I'll do some in marker because I'm trying to figure out the value. And if I'm doing a piece that's like really got a lot of color, I'll just do like little colored pencil sketch or something like that. I think that can be helpful. The other thing that can help you too, it sounds like you're doing something like pencil or colored pencil. If you want to follow up with the material, that would help. But for example, let's say you're using colored pencil. If you start drawing really, really light, it's very easy to go over it. So some people don't do that, and they start drawing really hard and fast, and that's hard to recover from. But in general, in drawing, if you start very, very light, that is extremely helpful in terms of developing things. And it's a good point from 7A. I have felt for so long like, quote, artist was this title that I was reaching for but couldn't achieve because nothing felt official enough. It really depends on the person. I mean, some people are like, I so don't want that part of my life, because I do know a lot of people, and I had this experience too, where once money gets involved and trying to make income from your art, for some people, it like really ruins the process. I mean, that's the reason why I never did commissions again, because I hated the clients and it made painting not fun. And that was a bad thing. I was like, these clients are so bad, I'd rather be washing dishes. Honestly, it was just so stressful. But I think if you make art and you enjoy it, you're an artist. Like, artist is not a title. It's not like you're saying lawyer. I can't really claim to be a lawyer, but, you know, as an artist, there's no, I guess, thing you're trying to reach for. It's just, I think the important thing is that your artwork nourishes you in some way. Maybe it's not always rainbows and sunshine, but it's still something that I believe we do because we want to do it, even though it's very challenging. And so, Edie, the quick question is, that was already sort of answered by the previous question about painting over. So yes, pan pastels are not good for that. And Jesse says, loaded question. What are the things you most regret doing as a professional artist? I don't think that's, well, it is loaded. I'm not saying it's not loaded, but I think it is important for people to hear about those things. I think probably the thing I regret the most is following somebody else's, I guess, prescription for what an art, for what an artist in academia was supposed to do, because there is sort of like a checklist. It's like, okay, you get the job teaching, you have a exhibition history, you show at galleries, and you win grants, and you do residencies. Like, that's sort of the prescription for what you're supposed to do. And I think for so long, I just was only trying to do those things. That, number one, it was very frustrating because all of those things that I just mentioned, you do need someone's approval. Like, you can't just get a grant. You have to submit the application, and the grants are extraordinarily competitive. And in retrospect, I wish I had not limited myself to those things. I think because anything else that wasn't those things felt like a waste of time, because I knew it wasn't part of what would put me on the right track for academia. And so, actually, the real answer to your question is that I wish I had left academia sooner. That's actually what it comes down to, because academia was extremely limiting. And the second I left, I was like, oh my gosh, this huge weight is off my shoulders. And I just thought that was extraordinary. Brandon says, I often have problems setting goals based on what others expect of me. How do you differentiate goals based on what you want versus what other people expect of you? Yeah, that's the exact same thing that I was just talking about. I think it sort of depends who that's coming from, because I will say there are some people in your life who think they're helping you as an artist, but who really are not. For example, somebody I knew, their dad was giving them so much career advice about being an artist and telling them to do all these things. And I just thought that was so unfair, that the father had all these expectations for what their kid should have been doing as an artist, and yet he didn't know anything about the art field. I mean, it'd be like me giving advice to an Olympic athlete, like, oh, I think you should do this. Like, I'm not going to give them good advice. And so you do have to learn to differentiate if the person who's talking to you, no matter how well-meaning they are, because oftentimes they may not know, are they really the right person to help you set those goals? Because some people want to help you, but they give you the wrong advice. And there are some people out there who are not nice. There are some people out there who will make you think you need to do something when really you don't. I mean, I think a lot of that is the hyperbole that happens in the internet. It's just everything's so black and white. It's like this or this. I'm like, no, there's so many nuances. There's so many variations of how this thing could go. And so I think a lot of it also is hearing other opinions, because I think if you just listen to a few people, you're not really seeing the landscape of what's out there. So I think finding people who really are going to support you, who want you to succeed, and also people who have the expertise to back that up. Thank you so much, Piggy Butt, for the super sticker. We so much appreciate your support. You guys are such a big part of why we are here today. And going back to what Pam says, this is not just about money. There's a good exchange of info here. Well, I hope there is. But I will tell you guys that a fundamental reason I started ArtProf was to make art education accessible and free to everybody who wants it, because there are lots and lots of platforms where you can learn to do art. And a lot of them charge money, which I understand. I mean, people should be paid for their work. That's totally fine. But I'm crazy and I'm a bad business person. And I just decided from the get-go, we're not going to charge for content. We're going to keep everything free so that anybody who wants to learn art education can have access to that. Because the other thing about academia, which I think that really bothered me, is that there's a lot of gatekeeping in academia, and most people cannot have access to that. Most people are not in situations where they can pay, what, $80,000 a year, I think is what RISD costs now. And I just really felt it was important to give everybody a chance. So any way that I can level the playing field a little bit for some people on the world, that is very important to me. I mean, it's a bad business plan and I don't recommend it. So if you want to start an art education platform, definitely charge for the content that you make. Otherwise, you'll be in our situation where we do rely on our audience and donations to stay up and running. And budget is always a worry for me. I wish I could sleep better at night, but I can't because, again, terrible business model. I don't recommend that. That's not true. They don't take half. So another thing that I was thinking as well, as far as academia goes, yeah, like Seven Angelics says, academia sounds terribly concerned with its own little circle from the stories I've heard. The world of academia, once I stepped out of it, it is so tiny. It's this little bubble on this gigantic planet of people. And I can tell you guys, once I left academia, I mean, I feel so ignorant to say this, but I could not believe how many people just, academia is just not a thing. It's just, I don't know. I think the thing about academia is you're sort of told that, okay, these 15 people matter. And so nobody else does. And I don't like that because, oh, what if those 15 people don't like you? You know, you have to get them to like you. A lot of it is being part of a club, which I think is not a good thing. But also the types of people that I have engaged with here in circumstances where people aren't paying $80,000 a year, I've met incredible people here that I never, ever would have met. I've met people from all over the world. I've talked to people with so many different backgrounds. I mean, it really made academia seem extremely homogenous by comparison. I mean, if you compare anything to the rest of the world, it's going to come across that way. Yes, that's what it is. It's a click. And you know something? It's sort of frustrating to me that while I'm going to the Southern Graphics Council conference, the printmaking conference, which again, thank you so much, everybody, for sending me there. Wouldn't have gone without your support. But it's like, I go there and really, I'm sorry to say this, but you really feel like you're like, oh yeah, it's the other club members. I mean, it really is like that. Jen says, yeah, I admit, I have felt bitter about people who had the privilege of getting higher education because I would love to just be in school, get all the degrees, but I just could never afford it. Most people can't. It's such a tiny percentage of people that can, number one, take that time off, number two, pay for it, and number three, continue to survive. I mean, it's a huge investment of time and money. And honestly, I don't even know that that way of learning is super, super important. There are huge advantages to it, obviously. But you know what was very funny is I was on a set. This was when I flew to Toronto. I was on that TV show, the science show, The Nature of Things, which is a big science show in Canada. And I was talking to the sound guy and telling him, oh, I really wish I had better experience in sound because it's the one tech area that I really have not addressed very much and that I really, really wish I had experience with. I was like, oh, it'd be so nice if I could go back and do a degree in film and do all that. And you know what he said to me? He was like, no, you can learn it all online. And I was like, really? He's like, there's no reason to go back to school. And it sort of makes sense because in school, they do make you do a lot of things that are not that thing that you want. And so I'm not saying that's not a good thing, because I love that I did things that I had no idea about in school. But if you want to learn, say, sound for one very particular reason, there's no way that dropping everything and going to like a four-year degree program is really helpful. So I really, really loved that he said that to me, because it just sort of put things in perspective. Nathaniel says, so glad to catch some of this live. Life has been stressful, so art making has been on pause, but art prof helps me grow as an artist even when I'm not making work. Well, guess what, Nathaniel? You are making work if you think about stuff. I know that sounds really weird, but Blue Wolf, who's a moderator in our Discord, she told me, listen, I don't have a lot of time to make work right now, but she said she's thinking about it. And you know something? At a certain point, she was able to do some work, and I was with her, I think it was in a live session, and she's like, oh my gosh, because I've been thinking about all those things, now I can implement them. And it was amazing. Like, she really improved from all that thinking in her head. She wasn't physically making the artwork, but it was in there and she was thinking about it. So Nathaniel, that counts. You don't have to be moving your hand to be thinking about or developing your mind as an artist. Louise says, how does an artist come up with a whole collection? I've just been trying out so many different things with my ceramics, but I don't know what to stick with. Okay, I'm assuming you mean like a series of pieces. So typically, let's just say, for example, you were going to do a solo show at a gallery, okay? And depends on the gallery, obviously, but for a lot of artists, it's like about 20 pieces or so. Depends on the gallery space as well. But I think a lot of it is about, number one, is that the best thing for you to do right now? And number two, is it something that you really are going to enjoy? Because the thing is, not every subject is great for a series. Like, there are definitely a lot of subjects where they're sort of like one-off pieces. I've done pieces like that, where I just did that, and that was it. I didn't really follow up or anything, and that's fine. I mean, especially if you are just getting started as an artist, you want to try a lot of different things. One-off pieces is the way to go. Now, if you do want to create a series, I think the thing to remember is that, number one, series take a really long time to develop. It's not really the type of thing where you can just make 20 pieces. It's a lot of planning. You have to see the scope of the project in addition to the individual artworks. And so there has to be some type of cohesion. Now, some things that people do to keep things cohesive would be to say, use the same medium. I know some people, they'll just say, okay, all the paintings in the series are the same size. And sometimes that brings cohesion as well. But the other thing that I tell people, like, listen, if you really want to do a series, the best way to find that subject is to look back at your older pieces and ask yourself, is there a pattern here? Am I noticing that this is a subject, or there's a way of working that it keeps showing up? Because chances are that's already happening. It's just, if we don't step back to look for that thing, we're not thinking about it. So sometimes you go through and you're like, wow, I actually paint a lot of sheep. It is oftentimes like that, where you don't even notice it. And you're like, oh my gosh, I must really like this. And so a lot of a series is sometimes recognizing the pattern. And then number two, deciding that you want to do something with that. And a series doesn't have to be all serious and big and ambitious. It can be a small thing. It's something that can be on a humble scale. Because it is a great exercise. Like, it's a very different challenge. Like, if you make one painting, okay, that's a painting. But if you make 15 paintings, why do they relate? How do they work as a group? Because ideally, a really strong series is one where the individual paintings work on their own, but as a group, they're stronger, or you see relationships between the paintings that then enhance your understanding of the work. And we also have Janet, who says, how does virtual classes work in art? I've been trying to figure out how that works. But how does that work? I'll learn to do sound at church. I take lessons from one lady, but if I wanted to learn more virtually, how does that work? Well, my suggestion, I know I'm very biased, okay? Take a workshop with us, because we have a pretty good system. Well, I like to think we do. Maybe some of you guys in the chat can chime in if you've done a workshop before. But the way I do the virtual workshops is everything is on audio. We don't do any video, because I think the video part of virtual meetings, honestly, is what stresses people out. A lot of people are really camera shy, and just making it all about audio is just listening to conversations, talking to me on audio. I find that far more relaxing. Yeah, tell me in the chat, who here doesn't like to be on camera in a virtual call or a virtual whatever? I don't. You know, it's weird. I don't know, maybe I'm a big narcissist, but every time I'm on a Zoom call, I always look at myself. I think that's really strange. And people are always like, oh, it's so nice to see people. I'm like, I just find it a gigantic distraction. I mean, it's almost like when I listen to NPR, I feel like I listen better because there is no visual. And it's interesting that the NPR, I mean, I love Art Shapiro. I love him. He's so awesome. And yes, I really want to meet him someday because I don't know, he's so witty and he's so cool. Anyway, I know his voice really well because I've listened to him on the radio all the time, and I don't feel that I need a visual to learn or listen to him. And so that's one key thing that we have in our workshops that I think a lot of people don't realize. And so I think at first people sort of think, oh, well, everything on camera is better. I'm like, no, cut back on all those distractions. Let's just listen to each other talk. So we do that. And then the way we give feedback is people will upload their pictures into the Discord to show their progress. And then I call on them to speak on voice, and I'm looking at the picture of the thing that they're doing. It actually works very well. I was surprised. Like, to be honest, when I started doing it, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work, but I've loved it. And I've worked with people in multiple workshops, and we always have a really great time together. And we also, Alexandria, ugh, cameras. I know, one of my former students was like, yeah, I really like that you don't have us be on camera. I was like eating chicken wings in the middle. I'm like, great. If it, I mean, it's sort of the old fart in me. I sort of miss phone calls because you just listen. Like when I have to be on camera, it's a little bit frustrating. And Donnie says, that kind of stuff is a lot of fun. I started going to Discord meetings to hold myself accountable in art projects. Well, that's basically what our Open Studios Club is about. And you know what's very funny is I myself have been selfishly really gaining from the Open Studios Club, because it's time that I have set aside to work on things, and no one's going to interrupt me, including my family, because I say I'm working, stay away. And so for me, selfishly, the Open Studios Club has really kept me on track, because other times it's always so easy to say, oh, I got to do something else, or, oh, this is more important, I don't need to be doing that. And so I have myself really found that to be extremely helpful. Oh, you listen. Whoa, there's a recording of Ari Shapiro's memoir. Oh, I need that. I've been wanting to read his book, but I just, so busy. So I know I've got every excuse, but okay, I'm checking. If he's reading, I'm like, yes, like, you know, all the little nuances if you've listened to NPR as much as I have. Yeah, this is the key thing a lot of people don't realize about the workshops. It's 2 weeks of chatting, writing, planning. And that's very different. Sometimes people think it's just a live session, but it's not. It's like 2 weeks of support, which is really, really fun. Remember, everybody, we are doing registration for our June and our May workshops. We are offering flowers, printmaking, pen and ink, collage, and also landscapes, and water. By the way, there is no Discord chat at the end of the Friday night hangouts. We do have a Patreon group, which is a great place to hang out. You get access to weekly voice sessions with staff, and you get support in a small group of artists. You can sponsor a video. Actually, so many of our videos were created by generous people in our community who sponsored a video. Whole bunch of our printmaking videos, the woodcut, dry point, search resolve transfer, those were all because somebody sponsored those videos. So if you want to help out our community, that's a great way to do it. Art Prof has a podcast. It's available on Spotify and also on iTunes. And visit artprof.org. There's tons of content out there that is not on YouTube. Use the search bar to find what you are looking for. And subscribe to our channel for more critiques, pro development tips, and tutorials. Everybody, thank you so much for watching. I'll see you next time. Bye.